Okay, we're going to discuss next week's Sedra first, and then if there's time, last week's Sedra. As we've been doing, we picked the mitzvah from the Sedra to discuss. The obvious mitzvah from this coming week's Sedra is the mitzvah Paraduma, red heifer. So let's first speak about some of the halachos, what it entails, and then we'll speak about the ideas behind it. Okay, first of all, this heifer has to be lechatchila 3 or 4 years old. That's when you take it to make it into the ashes. However, even if it's younger than that or older than that, it's b'dieved okay. You take it with money of the tzibur. It has to be bought with communal money. And that money comes from the Trumas Halishka. The Trumas Halishka was the monies that the Jewish people contributed yearly for the daily sacrifices. So this came from that monies. If it has two hairs that are a different color than red, then if those two hairs are close to each other, it invalidates the whole animal. If they're far away, then two hairs do not invalidate it. But three hairs anywhere on the body of the animal invalidated. And the main thing is the color of the root of the hair, in other words, the bottom part of the hair, not the top. If the top is black but the bottom is red, you just cut off the black part and the animal is kosher. All blemishes that invalidate regular sacrifices invalidate the paraduma, and working with the paraduma invalidates it. And not only that, putting a yoke on it, even not working with it, just putting a yoke on its neck also invalidates it. The slaughtering of this paraduma, which is done outside the Beis HaMikdash, on Har HaZeisim, that's where you could see the Beis HaMikdash, the slaughtering of it was kosher with anyone, even not a Kohen. However, the receiving of the blood and the sprinkling of the blood towards the Beis HaMikdash had to be done by a Kohen. Now this Kohen, who would supervise and be involved in making the Paraduma, he had to be separated from his wife and house 7 days prior to the ceremony. And this is just like by Yom Kippur. 7 days before Yom Kippur, they separated the Kohen Gadol. And he was put into a lishka, a room, which was made totally out of stone. All of the utensils he used were stone utensils, which were not makabel tumah. And we'll see that they made tremendous chumras, tremendous stringencies in making the paraduma in the most intense way, that it would be no chance that anything should become tumah. We'll see in a little while why that's the case. And therefore, the whole 7 days, no one touched the Kohen who was going to make the Paraduma in order not to make him tummy. You separated him on Wednesday, always, in order that the fourth day of his separation should be Shabbos, because the halacha was that they sprinkled from previous Paradumas on this Kohen, just in case he was tummy nace. So they wanted to make him tahar, just in case. So the sprinkling has to be on the third day and the seventh day. So they sprinkled the first day that they separated him. Maybe that was the third day from the time he became tamid. The second day, maybe that was the third day. The third day, because maybe that was the third day. On the fourth day, that was it. Even if it was the third day, there wouldn't be enough days to sprinkle then on the seventh day. Because if you sprinkle on the fourth and that was considered the third, then the fifth would be the fourth, the sixth would be the fifth, and the seventh would be the sixth, and you couldn't sprinkle anymore. So there's no purpose of sprinkling on him on the fourth day, so you skip that day, and then you sprinkle on the fifth day, because maybe that was the seventh day from the first day, right? In other words, 4 days later, and the same thing, what's it called, you sprinkle to him on him on the sixth day and the seventh day. And therefore, what's it called, they've made it work out that the fourth day should be Shabbos, but anyway, you don't sprinkle the eighth of the Paraduma on Shabbos. Now, the person who sprinkles on the Kohen Gadol, again, they did this in very intense ways to take away any doubt. The person who sprinkled on the Kohen Gadol was a person who never became Tameh, least Tumas Meis, in his life. Now, how is that possible? They used to have children, women who were pregnant, who would go to a certain place in Yerushalayim where they had built these buildings in such a way that it was impossible that if there was a dead body under the ground that it should make anything above the ground tummy. It was constructed in such a way that it would never become tummy, and they gave birth there. So the children born there could never have become tummy, and they raised them there in that place till they were 8 years old. Okay? Eight is because usually a boy, right, can't become tummy from other things till he's about 9 years old. So they raised them till they were eight, and then they brought them with also great chumras to the place where they would fill up the water for the paraduma, and the place that they would sprinkle it on the Kohen who was doing it, and in order that they shouldn't be able to become tameh. They went on wide animals that separated between them and the ground so they couldn't become tameh, and those were the children that sprinkled on the Kohen who made the paraduma. Now, the whole ceremony was done outside the Beis HaMikdash on Har HaZeisim, okay? And they used to build a ramp from Har HaBayis to Har HaZeisim to transport the animal across it, again, so it wouldn't become tameh either. Now, the tzedukim in this halacha were more machmer than the rabbis. They had an extra stringency, and they said that the parah aduma had to be done by somebody who was totally pure. And he wasn't even a tvul yom. What's a tvul yom? A tvul yom means the following. Somebody touched a sheretz, some kind of animal that makes you tameh. So you're tameh that day, you have to go to the mikveh, and after you go to the mikveh, you're still not 100% pure. You have to wait till the sun sets, and once the sun sets, you're pure. That applies to various kinds of tumas, where you go to the mikveh during the day, and you have to wait then till sunset for the purity to be complete. That person, while the sun is still up, and he's gone to the mikveh, is called the tvul yom. He is pure, but not complete, and for certain things, he still is considered, tameh is considered impure. So the halacha is that the parah aduma can be made by somebody who is impure as a tvul yom. As long as he went to the mikveh during the day, even though his purity won't be completed till nightfall, he's still considered pure enough to make the parah aduma. The tzedukim, Sadducees, they were extra strict, and they said, no, it's possible. If somebody who's a tvul yom makes it, it's possible. So the Pnei Yeshua points out, whenever the tzedukim were more lenient, we didn't really make a big deal about it, because nobody's going to follow them. But when the tzedukim look frumer, there's always the danger that everybody wants to be machmer, everybody wants to look more frum. So they're afraid they would follow the tzedukim to be extra stringent. So they bedafka made the paraduma b'tvul yom. They would bring a sheretz and make the kohen tameh, immediately take him to a mikveh and make the paraduma before nightfall. Had to be done in the daytime anyway. And this way was to show that the tzedukim are wrong. You can make a paraduma b'tvul yom. However, since they did this, and they made him tameh, and they made the paraduma in this state of semi-impurity, they're afraid that people would think he could be stam impure and do it. So they went to the extreme of going to all these stringencies to make sure that every other possibility, right, was extra pure, in order that people don't make a mistake from the fact that we make him impure, at least partially. Okay. Any Kohen can make the parah aduma. You don't need a Kohen Gadol. However, if the Kohen Gadol chooses to do it, which he's allowed to do it, he does it in the regular clothing of a Kohen Hedyot and not in his special eight garments of a Kohen Gadol. Okay, and we'll see later what the reason is. Now, the way it was done is he took this red heifer and you made a big Lag BaOmer you know, bonfire type of thing. It's called a marocha of wood that they piled up. And they put the animal on the west side of this wood pile, which was the closest. The west, the Harazesim is east of what's it called, of the Harabais. So the west side of the wood would be the closest towards the Harabais. And then they lit the fire, and when the fire was, most of the wood was on fire, but it wasn't yet, the heifer was on fire, right? Then, oh, sorry, just forgot to kill it first. Okay, put it on the west side. Now, then they shechted the red heifer, the paraduma, and the Kohen who shechted it, and it didn't have to be a Kohen, anybody could shecht it. They shechted with the right hand, and they received the blood with the left hand. The Kohen had to receive the blood, and after he received the blood in a earthenware, vessel, he would then put his finger into the blood and sprinkle it 7 times towards the Beis HaMikdash. And each time he'd wipe off his finger and dip it again. Each sprinkling had to be from blood that was new blood, not the leftovers from the previous sprinkle. 7 times. Okay, now, they burn they don't burn it alive. They burn it after it's slaughtered, okay? And before it's ashes, but after the fire already has taken light of most of it, they throw in the following ingredients. An eitz erez, a piece of cedar wood, which was an amma long, about a foot and a half to 2 feet long, and as wide as a quarter of a bed leg. Leg of a bed, which was a standard size at that time, so that's how wide it had to be, and about a foot and a half to 2 feet long. A piece of hyssop, an azov, which is what's it called, at least a tefach, what's it called, long, and a shnitolas, a piece of wool, like a tongue of wool, that was dyed with tolas is a crimson color. And it weighed the weight of 5 shkalim, okay, 5 shkalim. The weight of 5 shkalim was how much it had to have of that wool. After it was burnt, they would beat it with poles to beat off all the little pieces into ash, and they would then sift it, and they would grind it until it was a thin, fine powder, and then they would divide the powder into 3 parts. One part they would put in the chil to, that was a part of the Beis HaMikdash, outside the Azara. For, that was there, for security. They kept part of it there. Then they, put another part, that they put away for future paros, because whenever they made a paraduma, they mixed the ashes with previous ones too. So they put part of this one away to be used for subsequent ones, and the third part was used to mix with the water and to actually affect the tahara, the purity, on people who became tamei from the dead. Now, in history, there were 9 paros made in history. One was made by Moshe Rabbeinu, and that lasted all through the first Beis HaMikdash, until it was put away for future use and wasn't used anymore. Okay, but it never used up. It was a special miracle that the afer that Moshe Rabbeinu made never got used up. But for whatever reason, before the Beis HaMikdash, the first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, it was put away, hidden away, and it wasn't used anymore. Ezra, when he built the second Beis HaMikdash, made the second Paraduma, the beginning of the second Beis HaMikdash, and during the time of the second Beis HaMikdash, there were 7 paros that were made over those 420 years. 7 paros. What? Could be that they had a lot of people who were Tamei and they used it up. Right, but Moshe Rabbeinu had a miracle. The other ones had... What? What's the problem? What? Yeah, that's their crime, but they're the Maisha in the time when they needed it. The Rabbanu Shem saw to it that they had it. And, okay, and the tenth one will be made by Mashiach when he comes. Okay. Everybody who was involved in preparing this red heifer became tamei, their clothing became tamei. As long as they were involved, the clothing they were wearing or the clothing they were touching at the time of their involvement became tamei, but they themselves did not become tamei, and the par itself wasn't tamei. Special halacha that being involved in it made you tamei. Okay? Okay, now, after, and the people who burnt it also became tamei, which is one of the enigmas of Paraduma. It makes people who are seriously tamei tahar, and the people who are tahar makes tamei, at least minimally. Now, after you have the ashes, you bring spring water, mayim chayim, okay, and you put it into an earthenware vessel, and you put the ashes on top of the water, and you mix them together. And anybody is allowed to fill up the water into this vessel, except for a cheresh shoten katan. Have to be an adult. And the same thing goes with putting the ashes on the water. You have to be an adult. If you're a deaf mute, a person who's mentally insane, or a minor, you can't do it. Now also, if you do work with the water, or you don't guard the water and take your mind off it while you're preparing it, also invalidates it. Now that you have this concoction, you have the water together with the mixed together with the ashes, so now you use that to sprinkle on people who became tamei by being in contact with the dead or in the same room under the same roof as a dead person, and you sprinkle this on him on the third day and the seventh day. Now, the third day means whenever you start counting. Now, there's a person who can be tamei for 10 years and never have any reason to become tahor. And he has not to become. We're all tamei. Except if you want to go into the Beis HaMikdash or you want to bring a sacrifice, you have to become tahor. So the guy could have been in Chutz Laaretz and had no reason to go into the Beis HaMikdash or to make any sacrifices. So he named tamei. Then he came to Eretz Israel and he wants to become tahor. So we sprinkle the thing on him. That's considered the third day. The third day means minimal for 3 days. But he's been tamei for 10 years. So the first day that he decides to become tahor, that's his third day. Okay. Now you need a minimal of 4 days before you sprinkle the second time. Now some hold that it's dafka 4 days. Now the second sprinkling has to be on the seventh day, right, 4 days after the first day. In other words, the third day. Okay, whenever the third day was, the next sprinkling has to be 4 days later, exactly. Not later or earlier. And the Rambam holds, no, it could be later, just not earlier. You need a minimum of 4 days in between. But if you want to do it 10 years later, the second one is also okay. Okay, that's an argument. The person who sprinkles the water on the Kohen does it with a hyssop, a azov, okay? An azov is not just one, he has three stalks of this hyssop, and each stalk has to have one givol, one stem. Not really. It's not the stem. It's the bowl at the end. There's like a stem, and then there's like a like by asparagus, the thing on the top. What bowl? Yes, yeah, that's what it's called. Yeah. So each one has to have one. So you have three bowls and three stems. And the Evid, if you started off with three, if you only have two left, is also okay. And it has to be, what's it called? Even if the bowl went away and you only have a little bit of the stem left, that's also okay. But you have to start off with three whole stems with the bowl. And what's it called? Then if it got, by sprinkling, it got used or whatever, and it fell off, and one fell away, that is okay. Okay, hold on, I'll just finish this. Again, on the third and the seventh day, and we've described what that means, and wherever the water hits on the body of the person, his whole body becomes tahor, except on parts of the body that were hidden. Can't hit his tongue, it hits his tongue, doesn't help, right? and also not his nails and his hair. It has to go onto his flesh directly, not on something that's secondary to the flesh like nails and hair. And it has to be done dafka during the day and not at night. Huh? If what's it called? It has to hit his skin to make him tar. If you want to be metayer clothing that became tamei, then you have to do it on the clothing too. So he could be dressed and goes on his clothing, and it could go on his forehead, and his whole body becomes tar. So you can metayer his clothing and himself at the same time. Okay. That is more or less, in a nutshell, the process of creating the Parah Aduma and what you do with it. Now let's see the idea behind it. The Sefer HaChinuch says, the Sefer HaChinuch was written to give rational ideas, tastes, to all the mitzvahs. When it comes to this mitzvah, the Chinuch says, I only wrote my Sefer to try to give some kind of taste, some kind of rationale, not the reasons for the mitzvahs, but that we could enjoy them too, rationally, even though that may not be the reason for the mitzvah, but it's a taste in the mitzvah. It's an extra added benefit of having some kind, something that makes it more palatable to us. But when it comes to this mitzvah, Parah Aduma, the rabbi said it's a chof. It has no rational idea behind it, and therefore he says, here I'm not going to even venture to give you a rational reason, except it that this is something that is beyond rationale. Okay. However, the Rikanti says that which it says, that the reason or the idea behind Parah Aduma was only revealed to one human being in history, and that was Moshe Rabbeinu, it doesn't mean that there's no ideas, no rational ideas behind the Parah Aduma. There are definitely ideas which we're going to mention. But one part of it, the fact that it purifies the impure and defiles the pure, that part, no matter how much you can say, you'll never get to the real idea behind it, and only Moshe Rabbeinu knew it to its fullest understanding. But all the other parts, there are basic ideas behind the Parah Aduma, which we will discuss. Okay. Beyond that, the Sefer HaBatim says that it's even possible for later generations to discover ideas that weren't known by previous generations. One reason is because subsequent generations add to the things, the research that was done before them. So they can discover things based on the research of the previous ones. And also, sometimes a smaller person brings up a detail that the greater person didn't think about. And therefore, once that detail is discussed, new ideas are presented, which the greater person passed over. So it's possible that new ideas can be evident to future, later generations than earlier generations. Now, what is some of the ideas mentioned behind Parah Aduma? Moshe Hadarshan, Rashi brings down, says that the Parah Aduma was a atonement for the sin of the golden calf. And the Gemara says along these lines, let the mother of the calf, the Parah, the heifer, come and clean up what her son messed up. Here's a marshal of a kid who goes to a party, the king's party, and he eats too much and he vomits and he gets the whole place filthy. Who do you call to clean it up? The mother. Call his mother. We'll see what the idea behind that is in a little while. So, just like the mother cleans up what the son ruined, the mother of the eagle comes and cleans up what the eagle caused blemish in the Jewish people. Now, Rabbi Yaakov Milublin says that's a very fine idea, but it can't be the final idea behind Parah Aduma. He said, I'll prove it to you. Because when was the mitzvah of Parah Aduma given? Not after the Chet HaEgel, but in Mora. In Mora was before the Torah was given, which was way before the sin of the golden calf. So it means that there would have been a reason for Parah Aduma even before the sin of the golden calf. So it may, in fact, involve an atonement for the sin of the golden calf, but that can't be the only reason because it was commanded even before there was a sin of the golden calf, just like the Mishkan. The Mishkan also would have been, even if there wasn't a sin of the golden calf, and now that there was a sin of the golden calf, the Mishkan also served as an atonement for the sin of the golden calf. But that wasn't its only purpose. Okay. Rav Gedalia Shor, as that's out, says that every mitzvah has in it something special, that specialness applies to all the mitzvahs. Okay, for instance, give me an example. The mitzvah of Esrog and Lulav has in it the idea of beauty. Now, the idea of beauty applies to all the mitzvahs. But where is its source in the specific mitzvah is in Esrog and Lulav? All the mitzvahs have aspects of them that are beyond rationale. Where do those aspects, where does that aspect come from? From the Parah Adumah. The Parah Adumah is the example of something beyond rationale. And that idea, which applies in some way to every mitzvah, there are portions of the mitzvah that are beyond rationale, comes from this mitzvah of, just like beauty comes from Esrog and Lulav in a mitzvah, this idea comes from the Parah Adumah. Also the Sfarim write that when you observe a mitzvah that has no, well, that's beyond rationale, okay, then it helps a person that HaKadosh Baruch Hu then doesn't listen to the Satan even when it's beyond rationale. Now, sometimes the Satan brings complaints against us that makes sense, right? And God should really listen to him and punish us. But since we are able to fulfill mitzvahs that are beyond rationale, God functions with us also beyond rationale. And he doesn't listen to the Satan, even when it makes sense to listen to him. Even though it's not rational, why he doesn't listen to him. Okay. The Yecheskel Levenstein says that the fact that we have this specific mitzvah that really defies rationale, and we see that God's wisdom is beyond our conception, so that in itself makes the Torah greater in our eyes. That the Torah is not just something that we can understand totally. Torah is beyond our comprehension ultimately also. And not only that, if the Torah which God gave is beyond our comprehension, then God's functioning in the world is beyond our comprehension. So we're easier to accept things that we don't understand in the world. How come this happens and that happens or whatever, things that to us seem incomprehensible or even irrational, we can accept that God functions on a plane way beyond our understanding. The Rav Yecheskel Levenstein. Okay, now, Rav Moshe HaDarshan, which Rashi brings down, says, like we said, that the Parah Adumah is an atonement for the sin of the golden calf. Now, the Rabbeinu Bachya elaborates on that. And he brings a lot of parallels between the Parah Adumah and the sin of the golden calf. And I'm going to mention quite a few of them. First, he says, what's it called? That the fact that it's red, the fact that it's red signifies sin. Sin is always signified by red. If your sins will be as red as a red-dyed cloth, then they will turn white as the snow. So red is a sign of sin. And the eagle, the para, is the mother of the eagle. So you bring the mother, who's red and represents the sin that her child caused, right? Now, it says it should be complete, right? Completely red. But tamima means complete, perfect, which shows that the Jewish people were perfect and they became blemished. But it's possible that they'll become perfect again. So you bring a perfectly red animal that shows that the Jewish people are prone to perfection again. And the tzivui of this was to Moshe and to Aaron to show us that the sin of the golden calf is being forgiven because Aaron was involved in the golden calf. And therefore, he was also included in this to show that it's the sin has been forgiven. However, Aaron himself didn't perform this. Even though he was alive, his son Eleazar did it. Why? Because since Aaron was the one who actually made the golden calf with good intentions, right? You can't have Aaron be the one to make the atonement because Ein Kateger, Nasa Sanegar, the prosecutor doesn't become the defender. Aaron himself was blemished, so he can't be the one to effect the atonement. Also, even if the Kohen Gadol is involved, he doesn't wear his golden clothing, the 8 articles of clothing, he wears the 4 articles of clothing that the regular Kohen wears, which don't include gold. Because gold is a remembrance of the sin of the golden calf. We don't want to remember the sin while we're doing the atonement. So he doesn't use his golden clothes, just like on Yom Kippur. He doesn't go into the Holy of Holies with his golden clothes, only with white linen. Now it says that the parah did not have on it ever an ol, a yoke, which shows that the Jewish people threw off the yoke of heaven when they made this sin, okay? And even though they threw off the yoke of heaven, that they still had the ability to come back and be perfect. Because all sin by the Jewish people is only external. It doesn't affect our inner essence. So our inner essence is always perfect. We do things that, and the externals throw off the yoke of heaven and blemish us externally. But as soon as those external blemishes go away, we revert back to our inner perfection. And they, Mate Naftali says an interesting thing. What's this idea of bring the mother? It says like this, if you have a kid that does something against the king, and he's the son of a shifcha, that's the marshal. The marshal is, the mother is a servant woman, and you bring the servant woman and you bring her to court. He explains what's the idea. It's not that the mother has to clean up, but the idea is the following. You have this kid that acted impudently against the king. So you bring to court the mother who's a servant woman, a lowly woman, and the judge realizes that the kid was brought up, obviously, unaware of how to act properly in public, because his mother is a slave, a servant woman. And that mitigates the sin, because the kid never learned how to act with a king. He grew up with peasantry. Same thing. You bring the fact that it's not that we wanted to do something wrong. A para is a symbol of Egypt. But we were brought up in a bad environment in Egypt. So basically, it's the environment that is to blame, not the essence of the Jew. So here you see that sometimes a person's upbringing can be an excuse for his crime, too. The Medrash seems, according to this opinion, says that idea. Okay. Now, what's it called? You burn the para, just like Moshe Rabbeinu burnt the eagle. It's parallel. And you put in the 8 eras and Ezov and Shnitolas, 3 separate kinds of things, because 3,000 people were killed because they served the eagle. Right? And it could be that the sin was caused sometimes by being too humble. Person feels he's worthless and therefore he sins. Or he's too haughty. So the Ezov, the hyssop, is a sign of being too humble. Right, not having any self-esteem. The Erez is a sign of gaiva, of haughtiness, and the Shnitolas is taiva. It's a sign of lust. So those are the 3 causes for sin. People either feel they have no self-esteem, so they don't feel that they're worth anything and not therefore can't do any better. People who are too haughty, so they think they can do whatever they want. And people who are lustful and just follow their lust. So could be those 3,000 people, there were 3 different reasons why they were killed. So we bring 3 different things to represent the 3,000 people. And we put away some of the ashes to save and to put away for the future or whatever, because that's what's called the sin of the golden calf is also put away. And we suffer from it throughout the generations. Whenever the Jewish people suffer, a part of it is the sin of the golden calf. And another idea is it's metame, all those people who are involved with it, just like Avodah Zarah is metame, all the people who get involved in it. If you come in contact with idolatry, it blemishes you. And you mix the ashes with spring water, which is exactly what Moshe Rabbeinu did. He burnt the ego, mixed the ashes with the waters of the spring that traveled with them, and made the Jewish people drink it like a sota, like a woman who was suspected of being an adulteress, and those who were guilty died, and the rest, the ones who didn't die, was a sign that they didn't sin. This comes from here, that's part of the atonement, that the reason Moshe did it was not to kill the people who sinned, but to exonerate the people who didn't. Okay. The Beis Halevi says there's a more significant, more essential connection between the sin of the golden calf and the Parah Aduma. That is, what was the essence of the sin of the golden calf? They wanted to make something that was an intermediary between them and God, right? And they did it with their knowledge, not with God's knowledge. They wanted to get close to God on their terms, not on God's terms. Because there are things that are intermediaries, or things that represent God to us, in Aron Kodesh, right? You go to a shul, you bow down towards the Aron Kodesh. We don't think God's there, but that's a representation. So what's wrong with using an eagle and bowing down to it if you intend to use that as a representation of God? The only difference is that God said we could make an Aron Kodesh, but he didn't tell us to make an eagle. You have to relate to God on his terms, not on your terms. You don't create the relationship. God creates the relationship. Therefore, the atonement is be able to do something beyond your rationale because God said to do it. The same thing with the Mishkan. The Mishkan was also an atonement for the sin of the golden calf. And the Mishkan was done, Kasher Tziva Hashem es Moshe. Over and over it says, it was done because God told Moshe to do it this way, not because they wanted to do it that way. Because that was the way you have to do it. So doing the mitzvah that's beyond rationale is an atonement for doing something where you're the one who concocts with your rationale how you think your relationship with God should be. Reb Chaim Goldwasser, I think that was who it is. Chaim Goldwasser, I think so. He says that, interesting parallel. He said, what did they do by the golden calf? They took something inanimate and through fire made it inanimate animal. The Parah Aduma is the opposite. You take an animate animal and through fire make it into ashes, right, which is a domain, which is what's it called, inanimate. So you're reversing the process. Okay. The Maram Vali, or Moshe Vali, says that the Cheta Egel brought death and impurity back to the world. Had they not sinned, when the Torah was given, they reverted back to the level of Adam HaRishon before the sin. There was no death, there was no tumah. They would have been free from death, at least death as we know it. They wouldn't have lived in this world forever. They would have graduated to the Olam HaBa, like Eliyahu went up alive, right? He left his body and ascended, but without dying. The concept of death and the impurity that's caused by death wouldn't have existed. So, since the sin of the golden calf brought back death, so therefore you need something to that will purify the results of death to be an atonement for that sin. Similarly, the Medrash says that the Cheta Ego brought Shibud Malchios. They were free from any subjugation to the nations of the world when they got the Torah. Once they sinned by the golden calf, it brought subjugation again. Therefore, the sin of the Parah Aduma, there's Medrashim, that it atones for the various Malchios. It corresponds to the various empires that that subjugate us. He said, the Kedushas Levi says an interesting thing. He says, Rav Levi Yitzchok Mibarditchev, the Barditchev. He says that Rashi brings down that this is a mitzvah that the nations of the world and the Sartan question. Right. How come God gave such a mitzvah? What's the meaning behind this? So he says they have an agenda. They have a ulterior motive for questioning this mitzvah. Because they know, the Satan at least knows, and the Malach that represents the various nations of the world know what the reason for this mitzvah is. It's an atonement for the sin of the golden calf. And they want to remind us that we had such a sin. Because that's a sin that we're still suffering for. So the nations of the world want to hear, hey, what's the reason for this? They want to hear it because we serve the golden calf, which is a condemnation of the Jewish people. And therefore, God made this something where the obvious is not that it's just an atonement for the golden calf, but it's something beyond rationale, in order that it shouldn't embarrass us, that it should be obvious that it's an atonement for the sin of the golden calf. If you don't think that that's true, they found after the Six-Day War, when they captured a lot of Arab, propaganda and things, they found that the Arabs, before they go into battle, pray that God, Allah, should, protect them and give them victory. And one of the things they mention is that God should remember the sin of the golden calf that the Jewish people did and condemn them. So, till today, the Goyim are bringing this up against us spiritually. Okay. Now, the Maharal Prague says another idea of how this is an atonement for the sin of the golden calf. Basically, the sin of the golden calf is that they gave importance to a secondary cause. They saw the ego as something that was a cause that could bring them success. They didn't realize that the ego was emanated from God. There's nothing that has power in its own. It all emanates from God. So what are you going to the intermediary? Go to the source. So what do? We bring the mother. The mother shows us the ego is not an independent force. It comes from another force, which is the mother. And that mother came from another mother. And if you trace everything back to its source, what do you come to? God. So that atones for the sin of approaching the ego as an independent force. Bring the mother and show that everything emanates from something else. And that's also why it purifies contact with the dead. Because when you come in contact with a dead body, it gives you the impression that spiritual and physical can be separated. And therefore, God has nothing to do with this body because it's bereft of any spiritualism. It's totally physical. So you begin to see a world where there's things separated from God. But the truth is, nothing is separated from God. Right. Right, exactly. So the same thing. When you see something physical, then you don't see the spiritual. You see the neshama's out. You begin to think that physical can be separated from spiritual, and it really can. So the apron of the paraduma connects the physical paraduma, the ashes, which are physical, right, and the water, which is spiritual, and you see that they're connected. That makes the tahara. Okay. Now, on the other hand, so that's one way of looking at this, that it's an atonement for the sin of the golden calf. Others say that it's in general an allegory to sin in general, how to rid oneself of sin. He says like this, as Farnell says, that the Torah mitzvahs are the true essence of life, eternal life. And therefore, any connection to death, right, represents a total departure from Torah and mitzvahs. So when a person comes in contact with things that are totally dead, physical, so it's like he's gone away from the essence of life, which is Torah and mitzvahs, and he has to come back to that. Now, everything has extremes and the median. The ideal is to follow the median course. But if you've gone to one extreme, the Rambam says, in order to get back to the middle, you have to go to the other extreme for a while, and then you come back to the middle. So same thing over here. He says, since a person, when he gets wrapped up with death, has gone to the extreme away from the life of Torah and Mitzvahs, so he has to go to the extremes over here. So what do? We bring things of extremes. We bring the aether, which is the extreme of Gashmias, right? Dry, burnt ash, and living water, the other extreme, put them together. We bring an H Erez, which is high, and an Azo, the Hyssop, which is low, two extremes. And this is what will bring the person back to the middle. The Sefer Habatim says that it's not proper for a person who came in contact with the dead, which, like we said, is the antithesis of the eternal life the Torah gives, to go into the place where you come in contact with God, who is the ultimate life and the eternal life force. So a person who has come in contact with the dead can't go into the Mishkan and can't eat sacrifices. And other tumas also, coming in contact with very base things or very material things, where there's no spirituality in it. And then a person needs to come back to spirituality. So we take the para as almost like a sacrifice. But it's a sacrifice outside the mikdash. For somebody who can't go into the mikdash, it's a sacrifice that enables him to come back to the mikdash. So we do it outside. And we take a healthy, para, that it's in its height of health, It's something that represents working the ground, and we reduce it to ashes. We take that gashmius, and we reduce it to ashes, and with that, we bring the person back to spirituality. It also has a similarity to the Sirah Mishtaleach. On Yom Kippur, we take a goat, and we throw it into the desert, right, as if we're giving a sacrifice to the powers of evil also. Right? In other words, God says everything in the world is important, and even the evil has a purpose. So I want you to give something for the Satan. He also has a job. So here also, the Paraduma, we do on the outside, which involves even the powers of evil too. The Midrashi HaTorah also says, the Para represents materialism, and therefore the people who are involved in it become Tamei. And however, he says, the Afer also makes Tamei, to show that it's not just destroying materialism that's okay, because you have to use materialism for a good purpose. It's when you misuse and abuse materialism that's no good. But not that materialism is evil. So therefore, even after you burn the materialism, it's still Natame if you abuse it and you misuse it the wrong way. So it's not the materialism that's a problem, it's the abusing the materialism. Okay. Reb Chaim Brisker also says there's a hint over here to Torah, how Torah has to be learned. It has to be complete, you have to learn all of it. You can't be with any blemish, right? Meaning that you have to have Yirah Shamayim. You can't learn it and not have Yirah Shamayim. And lo aleh, aleha all, you can't mix it with other secular wisdoms. It has to be pure. Okay. Okay, now this concept that it defiles the people who are Tahar, and it makes Tahar, the people who are Tamei, there's some ideas mentioned even in that. The Kliyakar says an interesting thing. He says things are affected by their opposites. Okay? He says that's why something can't become Tamei till water comes on it. Because even though water is a symbol of purity, but it is Ma'orer, it, what's it called, awakens its opposite. So until you have the opposite, it doesn't awaken the other side, the Tumah. To Zimela, the Paraduma has in it two opposites. It has the Afer, right, which is the, what's it called, the symbol of Tumah, and it has the, what's it called, the water, which is a symbol of Tahara. So the person who's Tamei, what affects him? The opposite of what he is, which is the water. So the water makes him pure. Somebody who's pure, what's he affected by? The opposite. So the Afer makes him Tamei. Each person is affected by the opposite of what he is. Okay. The Sifsei Kohen says another concept. He said, when you have the Paraduma represents sin. Sin is like a, what's it called, like something disgusting. Okay. When your sewer is clogged up, okay, you call a guy to unclog it and clean it out. So he comes, he cleans out the sewer. But what happens to him? He ends up smelling because he came in contact with the sewer. So the person who's Tamei gets cleaned out by this. But the people who are involved in doing the cleaning go away with a little bit of sewer water on them too. Okay. What? Right, exactly. Oh, no, he doesn't have to be sprinkled. No, it doesn't become Tamei where he needs sprinkling of the water. He becomes minimally Tamei where he goes to a mikveh and that's it. I was thinking of a different idea. The whole idea of Paraduma, which we mentioned before, is that when you come in contact with the dead, you are faced with a philosophical dilemma. Because it looks like physical things are separated from spiritual things. So the Paraduma resolves your question and answers the question, and you see, no, that physical things and spiritual things go together. And in fact, this idea of let the mother come, right, has that idea too. Why do you call the mother? Right, when a kid dirties, right, why do you call the mother to clean up? There's another reason why the mother. Right, you call the father. Right? You call the mother because nothing about that child can disgust the mother. Because it's part of her. You're not disgusted by your own disgusting things. When you blow your nose, it doesn't disgust you. When somebody else blows their nose, it disgusts you. Right, why? Same nose. Same, it's not your nose, somebody else. But what's the difference? The answer is, when it comes to you, nothing about yourself disgusts you. Right? But for other people, yes. A mother, that child was part of her, nothing about that child disgusts her. Because it's part of her. It's her. So you call the mother to clean up what the child vomited, because it won't disgust the mother. Because that's her child. Same thing with God. We are so much part of God, we can't be separated, that even when we're tame, even when we're disgusting, God is still with us. He doesn't leave us ever. So therefore, the Parah Adumah resolves the question. Therefore, the thing is like this. When I have a question, and now you give me an answer, so the answer takes away the question, and now I'm okay. What happens if I never had the question, and you give me an answer to a question I never had? Now, what does the answer do? It brings up the question. Right? So to somebody who was tame and had the question, the answer resolves the question, and now he's okay. But to somebody who was tar and never had the question, and now you give him an answer to a question he didn't have, what you're doing is arousing the question. Now he becomes tame, minimally. That's how it works. The Rav Moshe Vali says that the body of the para itself affects the tahara. That you burn it together with the disgusting things inside its body. Like all of its excretions and secretions that are in the stomach or whatever, that part is metame. So it has the power of both. Rav Moshe Feinstein says another idea. He says that everything has a place. Tumah has a place, Tara has a place. The gaiva, sometimes it's good to be haughty. Sometimes it's good to be lowly. So the Parah Adumah had in it all these different things, all the contradictory things, but all of them are important depending on the time, place, and conditions. So we put all these things together that seemingly can't exist together because they're contradictory, but they do exist based on time, place, and factor. The Abarbanel says a last idea. He says that when Klal Yisrael are going to conquer Eretz Yisrael, most of them are going to be Tameh, because they're going to come in contact with the dead bodies that they kill, the people. And then they're going to need, they won't be able to go into the Mishkan. So they're going to need some kind of atonement, some kind of purifier that will enable them to go back into the Mishkan. Right? So this is what God gave the Parah Adumah for, basically in anticipation of when the Jews will be killing their enemies. And it's a hint that we will deserve to kill our enemies and be victorious if we are perfect without blemish like the Parah Adumah. There's only one problem with this. The halacha is that if most people are tamei, then you're allowed to go into the Mishkan and make korbanos. Because tumah hutra b'tzibur. So if we're talking in a time when most Jews will be tamei because they come in contact with dead goyim who they're killing because of war, then there's no problem going into the Mishkan and making korbanos. I don't know exactly what he's referring to. Okay. Any questions on Parah Adumah? Yes. A yoke never was put on the neck of this animal. Secular wisdom, right. Yeah, that's what it means is the following. You can learn secular wisdom to make a parnasa. The Rambam learned medicine to be able to, right? And there is secular wisdom that definitely aids in the study of Torah, like mathematics. Can't build a sukkah and know the sugyas and sukkah without knowing mathematics. But there is secular wisdom that is not necessary for Torah, and just the opposite. It's a replacement of Torah, philosophy, these kinds of things. So mixing secular philosophies in with Torah philosophy, which is not necessary because the Torah has all the philosophy you need, right? That's what it's talking about. Okay? Wisdoms that would be in place of Torah, which are not necessary because the Torah is enough. You don't need those kind of wisdoms.
And he was not influenced by Greek philosophy.
The Rambam didn't think so. The Vilna Gaon says he was. Right, that's true. But the Vilna Gaon says that like we said, when you go into the sewer, even to clean it out, it leaves a mark. The Vilna Gaon says about the Rambam that in his quest to, like you said, refute what he did, he was minimally influenced also. And certain things that he said were wrong, he says, because of that influence. So the Nagon says about the Rambam. Yeah. Because only, first of all, it wasn't even 3,000. It was really only 500. Right? It was considered like 3,000, but it was only 500. But the rest of the Jewish people weren't punished for actually committing the sin. They were punished for not protesting the ones who did. And they were considered then accomplices to the crime. No, because some were killed, there was witnesses, they were killed by the sword of the Levim. Some of them died in a plague. The only ones that died, as Sotah is, where there were no witnesses, there was no warning, right, nobody knew, those were part of those 500 or 3,000, whatever. So some of the 500 were killed, there were witnesses and warning. Some, there were witnesses with no warning, they were killed by a plague. And the ones where there was no witnesses and no warning, obviously, died with this water, but it was, again, part of the thing. But the major thing of making a drink was to show that the 99% of the Jewish people were okay. Nothing happened to them. There shouldn't be any, right, but because they didn't protest, right, a person who sees someone else sinning and could protest it and doesn't, he is judged as an accomplice to the crime. Now, there, first of all, Korach could be that they had no connection to it. They didn't, Taka, they didn't at the time join in the Machlokas. And itself was a protest, right? Not being involved, okay? But here, they watched the people serve the golden calf, and they had no reaction at all. That itself was condemning. True, but people who just received the Torah, right, on that tremendously high level, for them, even a small sin is a big sin. That was the problem. The problem was who we're talking about and when we're talking about. Talking about not 40 days after the giving of the Torah, where they spoke to God face to face. They should have been on a much, much higher level, and therefore they were judged very harshly.